Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 565. And today I'm joined by one of my favourite humans in the world. Okay? I said that at the beginning of the B. Dolan episode, but I don't say it often. It just happens I've had two of my favourite humans in the world within the last month. And two of my favourite conversations in the world. I came off of this conversation and I was streaming on Twitch that night. And I said, I think I might have had my favourite conversation of the year today. And then I went, oh, but that conversation with B. Dolan. And I had a really nice conversation with Chris Glasson of the Hardcore Listing podcast recently. But yeah, this might trump them all. I'm joined today by my dear friend Ed Skrine, star of many a Hollywood film and just a great person. The first episode I did with Ed was like at least 8 years ago and it was a two-parter. And I've had so many people reach out about that over the years. It's up there. It's seen as one of the classic Distraction Pieces episodes with your Gail Porters, your Eddie Temple Morrises. You know, there's loads. It's up there with them. So I was delighted to have Ed back on and the timing was perfect. And Ed speaks so calmly and in such a considered manner. When we talk, it's never just people taking it in turns to have their rant or their ramble. It's always a real consideration of what the other has said, an absorption, and then a reflection. God, I sound like such a hippie. Damn. It's a really good chat, I promise you. We talk a little bit at the end about music, and we're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can get all my music, and you should. You can get my music and my wonderful merch. It's cracking. We're also brought to you by patreon.com/ScroobiusPipio, where you can now support for $1, $3 or $5 a month. And it all makes a difference. So if you've been listening, for example, since that last Ed Skrine episode, then maybe it'd be nice to chip in some money, help keep the lights on. You know what I mean? Yeah. And we're also brought to you by twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio. That's where you can come and hang out with me, talk nonsense, mess about. We have loads of music-based streams, we have loads of chat-based streams, we have game-based streams, we have all sorts of stuff. It's always a good time, and it's a wonderful community over there. That's one of the things that has been the best thing I've got from Twitch, is the community that I've got to meet and nurture. Let's go on with the episode, shall we? If you don't know Ed, you're mad. Ed's in Rebel Moon. As we recorded this, part one was out and part two was on its way. And as I recall this intro, that is still the case. But I'm very excited that part two will be out shortly and will be already out for those who are listening. I'm making a meal of this ending of the intro. Ed was also in Deadpool. I Used to Be Famous. Amazing film Ed did on Netflix. We talk about that. On the previous one, we talk about Ill Manners, which is what kind of started it all for Ed. Brought him from a rap career into an acting career. Yeah, I mean, I recommend you listen to this and go back and re-listen to the last chat because it is a classic. It certainly had a lot of things that have continued to influence me in my day-to-day life going forward. And this one will too. It was beautiful. We had a beautiful conversation and we hugged hard on greeting and farewell. So I hope you enjoy it. Have I said this is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 565 with Ed Skrine?
This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Look, it's all picking up. It all looks good to me. I'm here today with Ed Skrine. How are you, mate?
I'm good, man. It's nice to see your big smile, bruv.
It's fucking delightful to see you. And we've been lining out this up for a bit, but I feel like I say this every week. I think these things come at the right time, mm-hmm. and there's loads I want to talk to you about and get into. And we've tried not to talk ourselves out beforehand because mm-hmm. we were literally like, let's come up and record. Yep. And then we've spent 10 minutes having a bit of a catch up. And now we're like, oh, let's go in. But how are you? Just as a general across the board, how are you at the moment?
Well, today is a beautiful day, mm-hmm. beginning of spring, proper feel optimistic, come from watching my boy play football, which is, you know, partly my happy place.
Yeah, how'd that go? Had some trials.
It was really, really good, man. It was really good. He's doing us all proud.
Well, last time we saw each other, we were watching
your boy swim. Like we went along to a swimming lesson. I remember coming and hanging out, and you were like, "Look, I've got this, but just come along if you want." Because we were struggling to get a time to catch up. And I was, again, I love my first question on here is talking about that balance, because that was a big inspiration at the time of going, "All right, you've got this. You're doing big things, and you're dedicated to it." And we'll get into that as well. But you're also dedicated to making it work and balance, and you know, like how is that?
The two are definitely in opposition.
Yeah.
You know, the two are really in opposition, but definitely they help each other. I was watching Curb Your Enthusiasm last night.
Yeah.
Cass is a huge fan. Yeah. And he's been cussing me for years not getting into it. And I've seen a bit along the way. I'm season one, episode five. It's amazing watching it from the beginning and seeing, without digressing too much, the birthplace of, you know, the office, and even all the way up to People Just Do Nothing and things. It's like such an influence.
It's interesting in the beginning as well, because it is so hit and miss. Like, it becomes a tighter show, but as it gets bigger. But the beauty of those early series is there's loads that you are just like, all right, this is just...
Yeah, I mean, Partridge was like that as well.
Yeah.
And really interestingly, looking on IMDb, Partridge came out started three years before.
Really?
That's and so the Travel Lodge and all that stuff, really interesting in the shooting style.
Yeah.
You know, we all influence each other, but... yeah, really interesting sort of checking the dates. The Office started the year after that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, Brent, 1 year after. So it's, you know, really interesting seeing the influences. But anyway, so I was watching Curb, and Larry was getting so pissed off at American football.
Yeah.
And he was going, I hate this so much. He was cussing. And I was thinking, oh yeah, I remember when I used to really get affected by Liverpool and Ethan, so far ago, long ago, England football team.
Yeah.
And I remember reaching this point where I was like, I need to make this work, because my life can't go on like this forever. I can't, you know, be potentially crying every Saturday or swearing, shouting at the TV and have all this energy in me.
Yeah.
And I've really got to a beautiful place, so much so that Liverpool losing 3-0 to Atalanta last night and playing terribly is the source of an ironic smile rather than any actual negativity. And I can see the balance in it. And all of that long-winded stuff to say, I realised really early on in my career that I had to do that with my family.
Mm.
And I can't fight on two fronts. I can't fight these separate fights because I'm the one that loses.
Yeah.
And I need to make peace with the dynamic, with the way that they're pushing against each other. And I need... to, again, like football, kind of protect my mental health and protect my balance and my zen and my chi inside of that. So it's really hard, but on the whole, it's like being in a relationship. Mm-hmm. You've got to work on it every day.
Yeah.
There ain't no answers. Yeah. And the ones of us who've been in long ones for time, we ain't got no effing answers. The ones who just started today, you know, it's just day by fucking day.
Yeah.
And it's with intention. You know, much like creativity as well, you know, like Quincy and Rick Rubin and them that we'll talk about with the muse and stuff. It's like, we spoke about it before. We got to be sacred on the inside, man. We got to be doing things for the right reason.
Yeah.
And my life is nothing but number one priority, being the best father I can be.
Yeah.
And creating the best humans I can create.
Yeah.
And when I say the best, I don't mean, you know, most elite. No, I mean happy, balanced, good people to contribute to the world. That I enjoy being around and that we all enjoy it together. Number two, let the creative juices flow. Let myself let out that creativity, whether it's writing, directing, acting, anything. And then number three after that is exercise. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Martial arts and being healthy on the outside to be healthy on the inside. And with the three of them, what I've kind of realized is like, same way with your little mixer down there, is it's like, I've got the three of them and it's like, sometimes, like when Rebel Moon, when I was shooting that, it was like, all right, we've got to turn it up to level 11.
Yeah.
Level 10. And then, wow, the other ones, they really suffer, man. Well, exercise was on 55.
Yeah, and family was on zero. Exercise was turned the most up.
Yeah, right? And then you come back.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, creativity's down, you know, essentially down to zero. You know, maybe 1.5 because I'm always bubbling with little things.
Mm.
But family's up to 10 immediately, just like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, exercise, well, that's another thing. It just, you know, calibrating the body and also the timetable. So it's like a lot of my life I realize now, like I think even last time we spoke, which was what, probably like 19 or 18?
Yeah.
Fucking 18, long time maybe, ago,
yeah,
man.
19, yeah.
No, it was before. Bro,
it was earlier.
I was in my flat.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was 16. You came round to my gaff, innit?
Yeah.
I think that was 16.
Yeah. It's got to be.
8 years.
It's weird, isn't it?
Fucking weird. We've got a couple more grey hairs, haven't we?
Yeah.
Jesus. But, anyway, I digress. But, yeah.
The balance, I like it. I think the key word, I think, is balance there. And I think that's really important because I think often people in the public eye will give snippets of their life or their focus or their dedication and not explain that there's a balanced side of it as well. I'm thinking instantly of when that Mark Wahlberg exercise kind of schedule and regime came out. Yeah. And it's like, that's amazing. And he looked insane in that at that period, but it's not sustainable. And I think fitness, and I want to talk about that more because I want to talk about how much of that is about your health and mental health, how much of it is about the art form that you're doing, because I think these things are key. But I think it is one that's the thing that I feel I'm in my best place fitness-wise, even though I'm not the fittest I've ever been. Like, I'm in a good range, but I'm not the fittest I've ever been, but I've got that balance. I know that, right, I'm keeping healthy. I'm enjoying myself when doing it. If I've got a reason to go to the not enjoying it as much, but for better results kind of area of fitness, then I will. But finding that balance and not beating myself up over things. And I had one yesterday where I had a workout planned. I got there, I started it, and I wasn't feeling it. And you've got a choice then of going, no, determination, push through, accountability, all these things. And that can be fine. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it is right to go, no, I'm going to chill today. Today ain't the day. And then tomorrow I'll hit it properly and want to do it and want to enjoy it.
I feel like there's a lot of pressure on us from like clips of well-known figures that sometimes I enjoy listening to as well, being like, you know, you got to push through, you got to do it.
Yeah.
Kindness to yourself is, so if you don't do the workout that day and then you also don't go the next day and you also don't go the next day, we got a problem here.
Yeah, exactly that.
But if not, then take that day off.
Again,
don't go home and eat a tub of Ben and Jerry's, please.
Or maybe, but just a small cinema one. For me, I've learned is if I force myself on that day, then I'm going to be forcing myself tomorrow, and I'm going to be forcing myself the day afterwards. Mm. If I don't go that day, maybe even not the next day, the next time I come, I'm going to be so motivated and I'll do so much better and feel so much better. So
I think the thing for me is like the way I've always talked about stuff is like I train for the decade.
Yeah.
When I was in my 30s, I said, I'm going to turn 40. You watch how I turn 40.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 41 now. Watch how I turn 50, Pip.
Yeah.
Watch.
Yeah.
Watch. Same with 60.
Yeah.
Watch. And it's not like, oh, everyone's going to be looking at me. No, I'm going to be strong. I'm going to be mobile. I'm going to feel good.
Yeah.
You know? So it's that long-term thing, man. Train for the 10 years. And it's like, so yeah, I can miss today. But that does also mean that there's 365 days in a year and I better be training 300 of them,
if not more. Yeah.
But yeah, if today's one of the days off, today's one of the days off. And it took me a long time to learn that and be kind to myself. Same way, I think like something that comes with training, once you decide that you want to start training, is like a certain level of body dysmorphia.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really, really normal and something which I think that isn't talked about, isn't recognised like with a lot of men and men training. When I'm in the gym, I see a lot of people and I'm not sure how happy they are and how much like I feel like they're kind of a slave to the gym. And I might be creating narratives in my head, but I don't want to be a slave to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really, I've thought about it quite a lot recently. I don't really know exactly why I love it. I just know I love it. I love it so much.
Yeah,
I'm so happy. Like, I was thinking about it the other day and I was in my kitchen. I was thinking about when people say those things of like art changes lives and making movies changes lives. I always be like, shut up, you idiot. Shut up. But you know what I was thinking about? I was like, my happy place is like at the end of the day when I'm watching a show.
Yeah.
And I just proper switch off.
Yeah.
And I got so much on in my life that hour, I was like, actually, those shows do mean a lot to me. I remember when I watched season one of Westworld and I was just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, and certain things that when you watch them, you know, you watch them and they are amazing. And so I was thinking, oh yeah, I'm really happy when I'm like that. I was like, when else am I happy? I was like, boy, when I'm at Muay Thai, man, when I'm in the gym, when I'm with the community, when I'm with my guys, I got my kids playing in the ring, messing around, throwing Swiss balls at each other and jumping around. And, you know, I'm here empty in the tank, next to someone else who's empty in the tank, and you know, we're uplifting each other. Like, I'm so happy when I'm doing that. And when I'm on set, I'm so happy. I mean, there's a theme here with the triangle again. Yeah. I'm so happy when I'm on set and when I'm working, and even when shoots are difficult and, you know, not so enjoyable, and they can be like that outside of it. When I'm on set, they're still enjoyable. Yeah. It's only when I go home that I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, I want to go back to Hackney or whatever. But when I'm on set, I'm happy. And it's like, I don't know why I love exercise so much. I think about it with movies as well. It's like Rebel Moon. I pushed it so hard on that, more than I've ever done in my life, you know? And that was when I was also like, I'm going to show you what you can look like when you're 40.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even to the young pups in the cast and that, you know what I mean? I'm going to show you discipline. And at the end of it, I did think, I was like, why did I push so hard? Why did I feel I needed to? Now, when I look back, I say, okay, it was really aesthetically, I think it's really interesting for the character. And, you know, other movies, like I Used to Be Famous or whatever, I stopped training on purpose so that I didn't have muscles and definition.
Yeah.
This one, I wanted to be sinewy and weird and freaky. And, you know, I also wanted it to be otherworldly. I knew that other members of the cast were doing the big chunky muscle thing. I was like, no, I want to be weird. So, yeah, I get it. But you know what? I'm a good enough actor. I didn't need that.
Yeah.
I could have done it without that.
Yeah.
So then it's like, oh, was I doing it because I needed to, because I had so much stunts to do. I had a lot of stunts in this movie, more than any project I've ever done before. No, I just needed to be functional for that. I could have done resistance bands, mobility. Yeah. I could have done yoga and Pilates reformer and then just stayed agile. Just kept doing the Muay Thai. Didn't need to do nothing else.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. The whole cast, there's 10 of us in the cast. Everyone trained in inverted commas, but way different levels of training.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why did I feel the need? I had to be like, push it the hardest. And the whole time I knew like, this is a marathon, motherfuckers. Watch by the end of this.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I joined like 2-3 months after a lot of them. Why did I feel that thing of like, oh, I have to push it to the extreme, like really? And I don't know, man. There's different reasons. With Rebel Moon, if I think about it, it was probably somewhat like a crutch, you know what I mean? Like a mental crutch, because like I was missing my kids so much. We shot it in LA, you know, be careful what you wish for. The dream, I was shooting in Hollywood, bro, on the lot.
Yeah,
I've always wanted to do that. Yeah. I was
big budget.
Come out proper, the warehouse, everything, that warehouse, yeah. Come out the hangar, the studio, look up, Hollywood sign.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Bruv.
Yeah.
Look at that. Every day I was like, look, there's the Hollywood sign looking at me coming out of a studio. But Hollywood's a long way from Hackney. And it's like, it was horrible to be away from the kids that long. COVID restrictions meant I couldn't travel as much as I normally do. So that was tough. So yeah, a lot of pressure and all that stuff. And, you know, I wasn't very happy. And I wonder whether that was a part of it as well. It was like a sort of crutch, and whether I...
Here's something I can throw myself into and have to... Here's another reason I have to be here, because it's to push myself to this next level.
I think it was...
I'm not just turning up and clocking in, because I think that's a key thing when you've got kids, and I've not got kids, but I spoke to Simon Pegg about this. It's like, if something is going to take you away from your family, it has to be worth it.
Mm.
It has to be worth it artistically, everything. So I think if you are away and you are struggling, I can completely see that as making you go, right, well, I need to be putting everything into this, because I don't want to walk away from this and just go, well, I shouldn't have come. I shouldn't have been
here. This is interesting. This is like a fucking therapist coach. Because what I'm thinking now...
We exchanged a few voice notes, like a little while after you got back, and you said that it was a struggle. That was amazing, but it was a struggle. And I could kind of hear in your voice that it was like a wonderful... creative experience, but not the easiest mental experience and physical experience, you know?
And I think actually when I'm away and I'm leaving the kids, I never want time to myself. Not because I'm scared of what I'll do, because I don't want to do nothing. I want to go clubbing. I don't want to go drinking. Even if it's like cast dinners and shit, like we're going to get to know each other on set and we're going to... You know, if you're a nice person, we're going to love each other by the end of this.
Yeah.
Like, it will be the, you know what I mean? I'll be your best friend on set. I don't want to link up outside of it, man.
Yep, I relate on that.
You know, I've got so many friends that I ain't even got time to see back in London. Like, I'm good, you know? And like, peace and quiet is actually one of my favourite things. That every year that goes on, I just love solitude as well.
Yeah.
So if I get the chance for that, I take it. So when I think about it, going that hard with training, getting the stunt guys to do extra training, come and do this, it was also a way of just filling up all my time when I wasn't working. So I didn't have enough time to miss the kids and filled up the time. So it was just, wake up in the morning. And I'd wake up every Saturday morning after long days of shooting, and by Friday we'd be shooting until 1 a.m. So I'd wake up 8 o'clock, eat quickly, I'd be out of the house by fucking 8:30, 8:45, training, doing the weight training with everyone. And every week I'd think, I don't want to go. I'm so tired. I just wish I could lie in bed. But when I think about it, subconsciously, I think it was like, yes, get up, go, bang, work, come out, have a fucking coffee and a banana, and then go and do 3 hours of stunt work, sliding around and throwing swords and doing all this swinging staffs and all that. And I'd think, fucking hell, this is too much. I understand what a healthy load is, and this is not a healthy load. But I'd think, it's not for long, it's not for long. And now I think about it, I do think that it was like, gave me an opportunity to kind of hide from the reality that, that I'm in this industry because I love being creative.
Mm.
Saturday and Sunday is not creative.
Yeah.
As soon as I leave set, it's not creative no more. Yeah, I'm doing my sessions with my voice coaches, with my acting coaches. Obviously, I'm, you know, especially for a character like Noble, I'm having to learn fucking lines. There's some mad dialogue to learn, but it's not really creative.
Mm.
So I'm not really that, it's not really that stimulating. So the only other thing, my kids aren't here, exercise.
Yeah.
Throw myself into that, and then it can become something kind of unhealthy in a way. Although I'm, like, especially seeing part two, the action in that is really, really good. And wait till you see, obviously, the extended cuts, the R-rated ones, that really and truly is the movies we shot.
Yeah.
Let's have it right. The action is fucking sick. And the physique is insane in the word, truest word of insane.
Yeah.
Like, Zach released this photography book. And when I saw it, I was like, I'm a fucking psychopath. Look at me. Like, I look insane.
Again, and I think...
Because I was insane in them times.
It's what I wanted to kind of talk about, the work side of fitness. Because I remember reading, and we've known each other since before I moved into acting. And so I've gone through this whole period and reading all these books, and so much of it I don't agree with or I think is bullshit. But then there's always these bits that stand out.
Mm.
And I remember reading, I can't remember in which book, but it was talking about it's an actor's responsibility to have agency over their body and their physicality, to have that control so they can transform for characters and be what they need to be rather than just themselves acting. And I'd never heard the kind of the physical side of it. And I think Rebel Moon's a great example of that, because I think the physicality of part one, like as we speak now, part one's out and part two, you know, is on its way. I think it's a key part of it for that character. For what I loved about your performance in that was that you played this like boots on the floor, frontline experience kind of general, but then you played him as a shit grinning Tory, which just adds a level of darkness and fear. It's like, but to play it in that way, you need to be physically like, you need to be able to see that this dude is dangerous. He's not just a pencil pusher coming, because he presents at first as quite just officious and that kind of thing. And I think those things are key. It is key to have that combination to get that character across. And I think, that was what was one of the standout things of the film for me. So as horrible as it was, it did have an effect and land.
Yeah, and if I look back now, I think I did the right thing.
Yeah.
And if I look back now, I wonder how I could have... Not everything's fun, Pip.
Mm.
I was going to say how I could have made it more fun or better and all that. And not everything is supposed to be fun. And some things are just hard. And that's okay in this age that we live in where, like, we deserve everything and we deserve happiness and everything should be, you know.
It's a balance in this industry, though, because there is the kind of myth of needing to be, like, a struggling artist and or a tortured artist more. And I've definitely been on sets before where you're like, oh, you're just making this uncomfortable for everyone, if you know what I mean. Yeah. And it's like, it's finding that balance of, as you say, it's one of your three joys.
Mm.
You can't ruin it. Mm. You know, you've got to make sure there's something there. And if it is, as said, as often with creative things, it's the end result that's the bit, that's the joy. The actual process of making it might not be the joy, but the end result is. But I think there's a balance there. As said, I do think there was certainly a period where you'd hear of these people who are a nightmare to work with or whatever else, but what they create,
I ain't got no time for
is
that.
Astounding. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Like, you know, and coming from like my boy's football this morning, I was chatting to one of the dads And I was saying how, like, the way that the kids and the dads and the managers talk in football, it just would not be acceptable anywhere else. It just wouldn't be, man. It's fucking, it's like, you'd just be kicked out if you spoke like that. And I find it, I think most people, if they went to football and heard how, like, some of these managers will shout at 12-year-olds, you'll think, like, this is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And the way that I see actors sometimes on set, even sometimes on some of the sets that we've mentioned already, I find it unacceptable. Yeah. You know why I find it unacceptable? Because manners cost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be, of course you should be a good actor and be able to perform, but baseline, we're all at work. Be kind, be polite, say good morning. You ain't got to be everyone's best friend, but at minimum, be like kind and nice, and don't be one of those actors that's suffering so much and taking it so seriously that everyone hates to be around you.
Yeah.
And they're like crew members saying, I can't work on this anymore because I can't work with this person because of their process. And that's unacceptable. This is someone's mum who's leaving their kid to come to work as a third AD. And because you're rude, because you're like, oh, this is my process, which I believe is based on insecurity.
Yeah.
Most of the time, that process. Not for everyone. I'd love to watch like Daniel Day-Lewis, who's obviously the go-to guy that you'd think, like, I'd love to actually to see his process and to see if I disagree with it, because not everyone is the same. And yeah, I find it unacceptable, man. So even when I was like pretty miserable on Rebel Moon, big smile for the crew, big hugs for the crew. In fact, they were the ones that got me through.
I was going to say, mentioning the crews there is the key thing, because they can be so underrated or from the outside. Like, I think it's true when people say the people that are number like one and number two on the call sheet set the mood for a shoot. I think there's a truth in that. I think it can be a beautiful thing. 90% of the time it's been a beautiful thing for me, and that's inspired me anytime I'm climbing up any call sheets. It's like, right, this is how you're meant to do it. But I think massively the third AD, the fourth AD, all these people who are running things back at base and whatever else, they're the ones who set the tone, because the nature of this industry is you're going to get a 4 o'clock pickup time and then things are going to go wrong and you're not actually going to be needed until midday or whatever. And it's like, it's all these people that make this doable and workable. It's not necessarily the people who are at the top of
the rabbit. I agree. I think in many ways, the crew set the tone. Like, I think about like makeup artists and costume assistants. Like, after a while, groomers, stunt doubles, obviously you build up a rapport where you have this really personal relationship with them, this intimacy with them, where you see them every day. You see them every day. They don't become friends and family, but they become a part of your life.
They're more often the first and last person you see. Yeah. Say. We're talking hair and makeup and things like that.
And costume. They're with you all the time.
Physical contact with, and there is an intimacy in that. A mate of mine runs a charity called Haircuts for the Homeless. And on the basis, it sounds, oh, that's nice, you're giving homeless people haircuts. But he found really quick, it's the intimacy bit that they're starved of, that no one's touching them and engaging with them in that guard down way. And that's hair and makeup. And every day for several months, several years, it's like
100%.
It's big.
So at the beginning, they'll always be very professional and they won't say anything. Oh, everything, okay, how are you? Yeah, I'm good, I'm good. Yeah. And then after a while, you'll be like, oh, what's up? And they'll be like, oh, man, I don't want to say it. I'll always be like, come on, you know what I mean? Get into it. And if I find out that, like, they're not being treated properly by heads of department and things, like, that will ruin my shit.
Yeah.
And that's why they don't say anything, right? But because we're close, you know, we're there to open up to each other.
Yeah.
And it's like, let the truth be known. The set should be, at a minimum, not unhappy to come to work. People shouldn't be getting fuckered, and, you know, we should be being kind to each other. So whether it's people being pissed off with a lack of etiquette from cast members that are, you know, because of their process, or producers or heads of department, it's unacceptable.
Yeah.
It is unacceptable.
And it's interesting because we're getting kind of inside baseball here, but I've had actors talk to me about other actors that they've felt aren't professional or whatever else, or producers maybe and things like that. And I'll always take that with a pinch of salt, because there's egos involved. Whenever I've heard from hair and makeup about someone being a piece of shit or being a dick or costume, I'll take that a lot more seriously because there's not the egos of it. Like it's the real drawn thing. Because again, as much as I do believe it from other actors, you also know, well, I don't know how you were on that day and how that scene went and what happened. If you lost some lines or if this it happened and that. There's some ego there. So it's like, all right, I'll take that on board. Yeah. If I hear it more, cool. But I hear it once off hair and makeup and I'm like, all right.
Yeah.
That person's gone from my list of...
they've got a big cross next to their name, man. Yeah. I just think manners maketh the fucking person, man. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I just think it's like, it's so important and like, it's so stressful. Again, like, I went halfway across the globe to do that. Like, you know, let's all be nice to each other. Let's all speak politely and kindly. I don't know. I also feel like if I'm doing all that disciplined psycho shit all weekend and coming in and I'm, you know, if I can do it, come on, man. All you other actors can do it like me, man. Come on, man. Be polite. Like, come on.
Yeah.
You know? But the bottom line is, again, I think, like, with empathy, I think that, like, if I think of, like, one person in particular, then I think, like, it was insecurity. And I think, like, it was, like, things are hard. It is a high-pressure environment, and we react differently to it. And I think a lot of the people that are being rude and making crew members feel unhappy, they wouldn't dream of doing that in their real life.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make it okay? Not really, to be honest.
Yeah.
But does it mean that I can kind of like forgive or understand and empathize with them? Definitely, you know? Yeah, it's both unacceptable and understandable. Like it's really high pressure environment, man.
I completely understand what you're saying there. And I think that's one of the key things in life. Me and I'm a mutual friend, Chris Glasson of the Hardcore Listening podcast, who's kind of put forward a question today.
Oh, is it? We're going to get into, but man, send him and shoot my love, man.
As with Chris yesterday, beautifully reminiscent. He was talking about like when you invited him to come on set, and it's the first time he'd come on a set, and he was saying, I didn't know at that time, and you certainly didn't know. That was a real rough time in his life at that point, and that invitation came at the perfect point to kind of motivate him and make him go, oh, look at how things can be, and look at how you were conducting yourself. Exactly as we were talking about there. Look at how you were conducting yourself in this huge, huge situation. So, yeah, there's a lot of love there. But we've talked a lot about how I struggle with the way the world can be now, where it's kind of almost hate mobs and condemning people because almost every horrific act that's done, I can see in some way how if I made the wrong choices, I could be there, I could do that, I could end up in that place. And it's that weird empathy that, because empathy is generally considered a good thing, but it's that weird empathy that people sometimes don't understand because someone who's clearly bad will have done something. And not that I'll be defending them, but I'll be like, well, yeah, I think we're in an era where we like to imagine monsters and heroes.
It's so binary.
And there's so much in between there.
Yeah, we're not talking about paedophiles and rapists here. And if we're talking about it, I don't really want that much grey area.
Yeah, to be honest. Yeah.
We're talking about something way at the other end of the spectrum here. So even my choice of language at the beginning, unacceptable.
Yeah.
You know, even that, like, you know, I mean that in a kind of literary sense. Yeah. But like, you know, I understand. It's like, it's like my mate Aubrey once said to me when he was talking about his missus, man. I always remember, I always think about it. And he said, when he's pissed off with his missus, he just thinks... And he thinks, oh, fuck, what a effing sign or whatever. He says, do you know what? Have I ever done that to her or to anyone else? And I tried it myself and I was like, I almost never, I'm not sure there's anything ever that I thought, no, I never do that.
Yeah.
And I would never do that.
Yeah,
I've done that. I've done, you know, not being rude to people I said, but you know, like, And I think we have to remember that. I think you're right about being empathetic, but doesn't mean that we should accept it. Doesn't mean it's fair enough. It's just taking it with a pinch of salt.
Understanding isn't simply acceptance. Mm. It's saying, I see how you got here, but this isn't...
There's a really interesting book I read called Monsters, and it's what we do with the stories of monstrous men.
Mm-hmm.
They're really interesting. Most of the most profound conversations I have are on the mats after Muay Thai.
Yeah.
And there's one of my friends there is called Rosie Price. Rosie, really lovely lady. And I found out that she's a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And I read her book, What Red Was. It's amazing, by the way. But we would speak a lot about, you know, the creative process and our completely different fields and how they were, sit on the mats all red-faced and sweaty. And we were talking, I was talking about Noble in Rebel Moon and saying like, I was talking about Herr Seidler.
Yeah.
who was the character I played in All of the Light We Cannot See.
Yeah.
And just saying like how horrible it was for me to play a Nazi and to have a swastika on me, you know, and that my grandma and grandfather were political refugees. And, you know, the only reason I'm born in London is because they came here as refugees. And loads of my family were killed by the Nazis. And 60 years later, I'm being my usual jovial self, kind to everyone, swanning around in swastikas.
Mm.
Now, do I justify that because I'm earning money for my family? Is that enough reason? Do I justify that because it's been enough time? Does it become some sort of, I'd sit on set having these thoughts, is this cathartic for me? Yeah. Is this something that my grandmother would have liked to say, you know what? Look at the life I had when I was a kid and when I was a young person growing up, when I was a young parent. I wanted to create a better life for my kids. And what she did is that for my dad. And then my dad created a great life for me, and which means that I can go off and play these things frivolous, or, you know, somewhat frivolously, mm-hmm. play these characters. Like, what a luxury. Look how successful her life and her son's life has been, that I can get, and her grandson's life, to be doing that.
Yeah.
None of these really stick with me, Pip. Yeah. None of these actually stick. And then I thought, well, do we need to tell these stories? Then I thought, well, we've had a lot of World War II stories. Yeah, we've had a couple already.
Yeah.
You know, and it's...
We're familiar with the Nazis.
Am I bringing anything new to it? I think I brought something interesting when you look at the canon of Nazis on that show. Mm-hmm. I think other than being the only non-German Nazi, yeah, I really tried to bring something nuanced and different to it. But I struggle with that idea. And it's like, that's what I was talking to Rosie about, saying like, what do we do with these stories of monstrous men? And what do I do when they want me to keep playing these monstrous men?
Mm.
And that when I clearly can play these monstrous men, and I clearly enjoy it to a point, and I'm clearly good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what do we do? Like, I'm in this position where it's like, hang on a minute, you guys want to hire me for 7 months to be a space Nazi and like strangle women and punch people.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Because originally I was thinking, well, the difference between that and your character in If Beale Street Can Talk and Rebel Moon is, it's fiction. It's a fictional character. But then what is the difference? You're still portraying those same traits and those same, as you say, you're essentially a space Nazi.
Yeah, I mean, if Officer Bell from Beale Street was, you know, came striding out of the spaceship, he would do it completely differently.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been, he was a very different energy, and there was a, because of the great writing of, and back, all of the writing outside of Barry's screenplay that I had from James Baldwin, like, there was a lot of interesting stuff that I could do with Officer Bell where I could, I think, somehow make him feel human. And even though his role in the piece was to be the antagonist, I was like, oh, you know, I think there's interesting things I can do here, and kind of this notion that, like, he doesn't understand what he's doing. It's like, you know, there's another scene that we shot where I say to her, oh, do you want me to help you with your bags? She's like looking at me like, you fucking monster. But I'm like,
you know,
I'm like, you know, these, it's like these people, like, I'm not racist, I've got a black friend.
Yeah,
do you know,
yeah,
you don't understand how institutionally ignorant you are.
Yeah.
And so without digressing too much, I definitely think all of the characters, all the antagonists I've played have all of these different points. But when you've got to spend 7.5 months being one of them, I've never spent that long being one of them before.
Yeah.
Because essentially we shot 4 fucking movies, didn't we?
Yeah.
Part 1, part 2, and then the R-rated versions.
Yeah.
7 hours worth of stuff. I mean, it's like a whole season.
Yeah, that's mad.
Of TV. It was such a long time spending in that place. And by coincidence, I'd played the fucking Nazi 2 months before without knowing, you know, which was great fun. Go over Budapest. You know, work with Sean Levy and, you know, do that. And
one of my favourite previous guests, me and Sean did a podcast. It was so good because
he
had no idea who I was, but he came on to just do some press and then we got proper deep into it, and seeing him change from press junket Sean into, oh, we're having a conversation about film and about the art and about the craft and about all of this. Yeah. Yeah, that must have been amazing to work on. But it was,
and even to shoot in Eastern Europe as well, you know, that was like to shoot in places that were, you know, directly affected by the Nazis. Well, a lot of the crew would talk to me and say they were Jewish and stuff, and we'd kind of talk about it. But all, coming back to this book, Monsters, what do we do with the stories of monstrous men? And it's a really interesting book. I would recommend it. I won't try and read the back of it to you off memory. But it's something which I certainly struggle with, especially because, like, in real life, like, I'm really preoccupied with being the opposite of a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not me saying, look, guys, I don't want to always play the bad guy. Nah, listen, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I spend my whole life trying to find balance and light, actively trying. Not just living out life, normal.
Yeah.
No, like, trying to be a good person and trying to always be better and trying to help and bring people together. So to play these monsters, there's a level of, like, Jungian shadow work to it for sure, where you get to, like, you know, let it out there and be, you know, explore the shadows, man. Explore the dark side. These are my shadows in Sidler and in Noble and all that.
Yeah.
You know, as much as they're Zach's that he's, you know, written into the screenplay and thought of, these are my shadows. So there is something Jungian about it, but at the same time, it's something that I find really I struggle with in a way that I find really interesting, which would not be interesting if I didn't enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I fucking love it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, after like, what? Wow, 14 years since my first acting gig. 14 years in the game, basically.
That's mad.
I'm like, I can say I'm good at it.
Yeah.
You know? I can say there's not many that can, like, I'm just trying to be as good as Stephen Graham. Yeah. Doing it, you know, the greatest at accessing the dark side, but also being a soldier of the light.
Yeah.
In outside of it, you know, he's definitely the greatest. But it's something that I do struggle with. And it's obviously more obvious when there's a swastika involved and my family's been killed and chucked in the Danube. And I'm aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And my life has changed, you know, because of that. Or was already on a predetermined, you know, my life was influenced so much before I was even born by it that I'm aware of. But yeah, even just playing all these monsters and stuff, it's like, I don't know, it'd be really interesting to sit around with, like, Johnny Harris. I mean, these are all guests of yours.
Yeah,
Stephen, if only. Did you do Alan Rickman?
No.
Rest in peace.
Sadly didn't.
The greatest antagonist ever.
Yeah.
Who else are we putting in this debate conversation?
I think, we've got Johnny and Stevie.
Are we bringing Joe Pesci in for this?
Yeah, it depends where we're going.
Well, I think it's what do we do with the stories of monstrous men when we are good people? Mm. I'm assuming Joe Pesci is a good person.
Yeah, you'd hope.
But I think it's a really right. interesting debate, which not everyone needs to come to terms with, because not everyone ends up playing them characters.
I've spoken a few times about doing a kind of almost a broader mental health conversation on actors, because again, I know numerous people have played against these evil characters, these monsters, and that's been as traumatic. You know, if you're the Vicky McClure to Johnny Harris, then how do you process that and take
Definitely.
That on board? I've spoken Definitely. Privately and I think on the podcast to Neve Algar about some of the places that she's had to go to in these roles, and then you're in your hotel room and we're done.
Mm.
And I think there's loads there that, weirdly, I've got a script kind of that's based around that, but we just take for granted, oh, they did that, how amazing, and don't think of, like, oh, I couldn't do that, because, well, you could, but you'd have to go to somewhere really fucking dark, and could you pull yourself out of it and come back out the other side? It's, I think it's a fascinating subject. And I think what I was going to say when you were talking about balance and throwing yourselves into things is, how do you find that in an industry that isn't necessarily or hasn't traditionally been supportive of that? And I think it is getting better. But I was chatting, who was I chatting to? I was talking to them in WUMI. We were talking about how it should almost be mandatory in certain stories and certain sets to have some kind of offloading therapy on a day that there's these big scenes. WUMI was talking about how it should always be offered. But I think, like, my mum works for the Samaritans, and it's mandatory that at the end of every shift they ring one of the other Samaritans who's the offload for that night, and they say what's happened, and they offload it. So they're not taking it home with
them. Every shift.
Every shift. Brilliant. And again, I'm like, I'm not saying have full therapy, but I think if you've got these huge and dramatic scenes, it would be quite easy to say, before you go, you each have to sit down and just talk about how you feel and make sure you're not... Because again, more often than not, we are away from our family and our support networks and all of these things. And you touched upon it. You're out there living the dream in Hollywood. It might not be easy to ring one of your boys up and go, I'm struggling, man, because they might be working in a factory or working doing this and struggling. Yeah. And you're going, I'm really struggling in my nice apartment in Hollywood.
Problems.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. It might not.
It's really hard to pretend to be a bad person.
Yeah.
When I'm a nice person.
Yeah, exactly.
It
might not land. And yeah, I definitely think there could easily be some stuff like that brought in. Again, it wouldn't need to be on every set and every scene and every story, but definitely think there could be something there that would really help people not end up in a dark place with it.
We had a really, really, really sad situation on Rebel Moon where one of the people that worked in the ladies that worked in the stunt department that was on logistics, she got in a car accident and she died, man. While we were like 5 months in or something. And yeah, it was so sad, man. So sad. You know, we're going out making these silly movies, and even if the movies aren't silly, it's silly movies for people to be dying on. And they offered therapy.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's so good.
Yeah.
And I thought, why does someone have to die for you to offer us therapy?
It shouldn't need
to. I thought to myself,
yeah,
I've needed therapy this whole time. You know, I do it myself anyway. So I was doing my own stuff, but not everyone can. And not everyone is in that rhythm and groove. But like, I thought, wow, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. And I bet it's like protocols, which is a really good thing that they do that now. But
as I said, it's allowed to be a great thing and something that makes you go, all right, why did it take this?
Yeah.
You know, why did it take this to get this offered?
Yeah, I think... It's why like now I've graduated from like young pup. I mean, last time we were talking about imposter syndrome a lot last time, weren't we?
Yeah.
Well, I graduated now.
Yeah.
Ain't no imposter syndrome in this room anymore. Yeah. And Rebel Moon, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm an older actor now.
Mm.
You know, like the youngest actors here are like, well, Charlotte was 17. I'm 41. Like, I'm more than old enough to be our pops. Then you got Sky, he's 21. I'm definitely old enough to be his pops. I'm like basically double his age.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then even like some of the older actors, I'm like, well, you lot are 35.
Yeah.
Then, of course, I got Jaimon, who's like, you know, he's got a couple years on me.
Yeah. Anthony, one of the first people I worked with on one of the first sets that I've ever on, and he was just
he's a sweetheart. I know exactly how he was.
Beautiful human,
Because that's what he's like. Yeah, yeah. What a lovely man. What a sweet, sweet soul, man. Bless Jaimon, man. But and then obviously Tony Hopkins is my favourite actor of all time. But he wasn't on set, but you know, he's obviously older in the cast. But yeah, other than that, I was like, wow, this is weird. I'm one of the older ones now. And I've always wanted to like, because when I started in the game, I felt like I didn't have a Scooby what was going on. I was so like out of my depth. Yeah. And it took basically about 6 years to try kind of work out what the fuck was going on and what everyone's jobs were and what the hell, you know.
Yeah.
Why do you need all these, you know, it just couldn't understand anything. And I felt like people didn't really tell me stuff, man. And I feel like people didn't kind of like put their arm around me and kind of help me out. Man, I know I'm a big geezer. I look like a like strong, confident guy, but like I proper didn't know. And I really wish they did. So I do that. Yeah. Every set I'm on now, I proper take that role and I'll, you know, speak to them and say, listen, you're allowed to say no, you're allowed to do this. When they tell you to do that, let me tell you what I do when they tell me to do that.
It's
always done with grace, but I say, no, I won't be doing that, but thank you very much. You know, you have the choice and try and give them all this stuff. And it's like seeing these youngsters on these big movies like Rebel Moon, it was so triggering for me because I was like, oh man, I need to protect these lot, man.
Yeah.
This is the stuff that like, this is mental health nightmares.
Yeah.
They look so happy. Yeah, yeah. All their friends are like, you're in Hollywood, bruv. You're over there. But they are 21 or 25, 23, and they're in LA by themselves. And LA is a strange place at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And all this pressure, and they're being made to train and all of that, like I did, even though I obviously needed to train that much. I'm not sure they needed to do the same kind of level. So they were under all of this pressure and that without the experience and everything that I've got. So I proper felt sorry for them, man. Yeah. Not even sorry for them. I proper felt like they needed more support.
Yeah.
So back to your therapy.
Yeah.
I think like for all actors under 25, it would be brilliant to be able to offer, to be able to have kind of like a mandatory checking in system. And like, you know, I urge you, brother, as a budding filmmaker, and same with me, when I do my first feature and all that, is to create that environment. I think we will, but like to be actually, I know it's in your nature and it's in my nature, but that doesn't mean that you'll have time to think about it, because you won't, because you'll have a million questions to answer and you'll be very preoccupied with the fact you've got to get all this and your shot list, and you'll be geeking out with your cinematographer and you might not think about your 25-year-old.
Yeah.
And they really need protecting, because like my training, we train for decades. These youngsters look at a movie like Rebel Moon, I think that's the end. Okay, wow, Rebel Moon. No, when I do Rebel Moon, I'm thinking, well, yeah, this is just one of the next and one of the last.
Yeah.
And even when they say, oh, it's this, it's that, I say, just relax, man. I've been part of big movies before that was, you know, supposed to do this. And, you know, it doesn't always get, just relax. Let's just enjoy the ride and we'll see.
Billy Bragg talked to me about this, was one of the biggest problems he sees with people coming up is they achieve their dream and then it just isn't what they'd hoped or expected. And he's like, he's lucky. He achieved his dream and it was everything he wanted it to be and he's continued there. But there's so much of that. You get that big gig and you're like, well, this is it now.
Mm.
Like, again, we've brought up Stephen Graham numerous times. I'm going to bring him up again
as many times as possible, please.
Him telling me about after This Is England, him not booking a gig for 18 months.
Mm.
It's like, that's helped. Him and Sophia, also in Rebel Moon, are the two people who had similar stories like that. And it was such... They were unaware, but it helped me so much in points of my career already, because I'll have these gaps and I'll be like, well...
Because when they said that you were 15 months into an 18-month run or whatever.
Oh, that's exactly it. It's like, well, I know Stevie ain't shit. I know Sophia ain't shit. Yeah. So it's like, so I'm not getting booked because I'm shit.
Mm.
I'm not getting bookings, if you know what I mean, because I'm shit. It's because of that's how this thing goes. But I was grinning throughout you talking of realising that you're... in a guidance role now as you're one of the elders on set, because I kind of had a fast-forwarded version of that because of Stephen Graham. So Taboo was my third ever acting gig. And on day one, he proper took me under his wing and we were the only two members of Atticus's gang. So he's Atticus, I'm his right-hand man, had these scenes with Hardy and all this. And he's like, stand here, because if you're in the background of my close-up, then even if you've not got lines, it will establish you as a character. Mm. The more everyone thinks it's about the lines you've got, it's not. He's like, I guarantee you go through so many TV shows that you think a character, you know this character, but they didn't actually say that much. They're just there a lot and all this. Mm. And then there's other points where he's giving guidance. And then 3 days in, they had three new members of our gang. And he came up to me at one point. He's like, do you see what you just did? I was like, what? It's like, those three didn't really know what to do or where to stand, and you kind of advised them and told them, because we're like, in this scene, we're not important enough to be hassling the director and asking what he wants from us, because it doesn't matter. It's the focus is on this. So I was like, yeah, if you start clearing up that bit and we do that, it's like, that's what I was doing to you 3 days ago, and you're now, again, on a far lower level. And it was a beautiful thing to have highlighted, because it was that natural thing, because even within that amount of time, I was like, right, I know that those level of characters, we can't be going up and going, so what do you want, you know, like, what are you thinking? Like, what's my intent in this particular scene? It's like, right, no, we need to just play it out.
Do you think there's a part of it with you? Because when I'm very aware there's a part of it with me that recognises their insecurity.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
And even though I don't feel it no more, I remember how it feels. And seeing them, and even projects my younger insecurity onto them, perhaps.
Yeah, 100%. That they very well might not have needed any advice or tips, but because of that, you're like, in this instance, oh, that was me like 3 days ago. It's like the first big set I've been on. I'm kind of nervous, and yeah.
That set looked fun, though. I love those period sets.
Yeah.
And, look, wicked fun. Liverpool, Manchester?
No, it was all London and Essex.
Oh, is it the docks in
Tilbury?
Which is where Chris came to
set. Yeah. Well, that's it. It's up the road from us.
Tilbury, I remember docks,
getting the email. We'd done a few days in London, then we got this email. It was kind of like, the next week, it's a bit out of the way.
Yeah, yeah. For everyone else.
And I'm like, I could walk there. Like, do you really need to give me a trailer? I can just get dressed in my room and come over. But
fantastic.
Back to kind of, there's so much I want to talk about, and we're going to run out of time. But before we wrap up on Rebel Moon, me and Chris were talking about it, and Chris was saying how he felt that
this is Chris's question.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. He felt that your character, it felt like almost it was an audition to be in the Warhammer universe. He's a massive Warhammer nerd. He feels it's going to be the next Marvel and things like that, because there's so many stories in that world. There's so many things, and Henry Cavill is now leading that kind of, he's bringing it all to screen. There's this long process and development. And yeah, he was kind of asking if you're aware of any of that, because he felt the way you played that, it was so, it fit that Warhammer universe so well. And in his mind, he was like, Ed might not know, but I guarantee in his future is something in this huge, big universe.
That's,
and I said,
so interesting.
I completely see it. Like whenever I talk to him about it, I'm a little bit of a nerd in that world, but not to his depth. And it is, it's as rich and deep as kind of your Marvel universes and all that, but it's already got all this established lore and...
Wow. Yeah. Short answer is I haven't got a fucking clue.
Yeah, yeah. Never, oh, that's it. I was like, I don't know if you're even aware of it.
Never heard of it. I always, when I was a kid, wanted to get into it and never did.
Yeah.
Definitely didn't have the patience for doing a little intricate painting. But no, I didn't know. But like training, every single job is an audition for 10 years' time.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So that was an audition for everyone, for the world. Yeah. And also just to show, like, you know, I'm getting better. And I'm learning. Do you know what I mean? That's that's what that was. So definitely this Warhammer thing.
Yeah,
100%. I'd love to. Suit you. Sounds cool.
I think it'd suit you. Yeah. Well, there's more I wanted to talk about on Rebel Moon, but I don't want us to run out of time. And like again, probably I was going to say a couple of years ago, but probably 4 or 5 years ago, we bumped into each other outside Des Hamilton's cast off, and we had a quick catch up. You were coming out, I was heading in
at a coffee shop across the road, didn't it?
Yeah,
Benugo.
We had a little bit. Yeah, we had a little bit of time for a catch up, and I remember you talking then about wanting to do more stuff that your kids could watch, and not just doing kind of angry grown up stuff that maybe might appeal to you more, but more stuff that.
The monsters.
Your kids were, less monsters, exactly that.
Or family-friendly monsters, like Monsters, Inc.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The right monsters. But
like Mike Fakowski, whatever his name is.
Yeah, that'd be gold. But I remember sitting down to watch I Used to Be Famous, debut from Eddie Sternberg.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was watching it because you're in it, mate, and it's on Netflix. And I was like, this probably ain't going to be my kind of thing. And it warmed my heart so much. I genuinely found it beautiful. I found it so watchable and believable, even though it is kind of so uplifting and positive. I guess, number one, how was that to work on? And number two, is that part of your kind of, do you look at roles and go, I want to do one that will inspire my boy, you know, and things like that. And my kids can watch and go, oh, that's my dad.
Definitely I want to, you know, definitely I want to. I know if I do two roles that are like good for my kids, then I'm like, all right, let me play a monster.
Yeah.
But preferably not for seven, game. 8 months.
We're back to balance.
Definitely. And it's part of me.
Yeah.
It's like the Jungian shit, it's there. The shadows are there, so let me explore them. Yeah, I used to be famous, man. I keep saying to my agent, like, I just want another movie. Like, I used to be famous.
Yeah.
You know, when I spoke to Eddie, so...
Because I had the monster in there as well. Like, not monster parts, monster, but your character wasn't the nicest guy at points.
Yeah,
you know?
He wasn't just some angel.
An angel. That's, exactly.
But I was signed on to another movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was signed on to, I was signed on to another movie that was really interesting to work with a couple of actors that I found really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't, I wasn't in... head over heels with the actual character.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of like, when I Used to Be Famous came in, I was like, oh, I know if I won't be able to do the two of them. When I went to meet Eddie and Collie, the producer, like there are some meetings I'll never forget, ever, 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 ever. And that was one of them.
Yeah,
it was just amazing. I just loved how they described it to me. You know, when I spoke to them, I'd had a conversation with C-Part just before that saying like, I want to do stuff in my own accent. I don't always, why do I always have to play posh people? Or why do I have to just be Cockney? Or why do I have to be this and that? Like, why can't I just speak like myself and my friends? I don't speak different from the rest of the community.
Yeah.
Everyone speaks like me. In fact, everyone will have pretty much what color skin they've got, what age they are, what gender they are, what sexuality they are. We just talk like this,
yeah.
Right? Why can't I represent my community? Why can't I be why can't we do that? Anyway, and Eddie was like some fucking fairy godfather was like, Ed, I want you to. He left me a message that like, I listened to that podcast I'd done with Sipa. He said, I want you to do that. I want you to speak in your own accent. And I was like, oh my God, listen to this guy. Like, fuck. This is a match made in heaven, man. And we just geeked out, man. And like from our, what we call the Zoom digressions, because we'd get on Zooms to talk about the character in the script. And we did like about 10 Zooms. It'd be like what it'd be like with me and you. It'd be a nightmare.
Yeah.
10 Zooms and we were like 50 pages in. We were like, we need to stop digressing, man. We're having too much fun and just talking about, just too much. And so anyway, when we shot that, it was such a beautiful experience to shoot in London and to leave the other project behind. Mm-hmm. Even though it was like the least important thing to me is money, but it's three times as much money. It was like significant, very significant things. It would have been the most amount of money I'd ever earned in my life if I'd have done the other one. But it's like, no, dead that. I don't want to do that. I want to do this. Not even dead that. Respect to the project. But like, this is amazing. This is like my heart. And I just, and then straight, and like when we were in the meeting, Eddie said to me, yeah, you can sing, right? And I was like, yeah, man. I mean, listen, if I can learn martial arts from movies, I can learn to sing, right?
Yeah.
If I can speak Louisiana, you know, street Louisiana for Mona Lisa and the Blood Moon, I can learn this, innit? Fuck, that was so scary and so hard. And learning the piano, man, it was so hard. And not even learning grade, whatever. It was learning just the songs, just the riffs that I had to learn. So straight into like vocal coaching and the piano stuff. And it was really scary, man. It was really hard. And like, God, I was terrible at first. But I knew I'd get it. I've got like a confidence in my process now that like, even when it's terrible halfway through, I'm like, I know I can get it. I just got to work it out. And it just wasn't working. We even went to the church studio in Crouch End. Mm-hmm. Who owns that? Someone brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Someone big.
And amazing, big, like huge studios in there, like, you know, and from my music days it was like bedroom studios and underground studios and fucking estates and people's basements and that. This was like, wow, look at this. And I was singing, and I'm singing in there. So we went in there, recorded the first recording session with London Grammar, who wrote all the songs. And I just came out and I was like we hadn't even shot a day, and I was like, this doesn't feel right. Like, I'm singing this character and I don't even know who the character is yet. I know roughly what it is, but I don't know Vince's voice, so how can I do these songs? And so we found this other guy, this other vocal coach, Joshua, and like, this guy is a proper peaceful warrior, amazing soul. He works with Ray, who just won the 7 Brits.
Right, yeah.
And it doesn't surprise me. When he told me that, I said, yeah, of course you have.
Yeah.
Of course the underground artist or the person that got dropped from a label that you were working with in isolation when everyone had given up on him, of course you made it brilliant.
Because he's
the most amazing man. And he just unlocked me, man. He unlocked my singing. He unlocked everything. And so all the songs, when I recorded them, when we went back in, he would be standing in the booth with me, kind of conducting me an orchestra.
Yeah.
And actually, he was my crutch. I needed him there. And I was so proud of him. So proud of him. And then so proud of Leo Long, who just did the most amazing job. It's obviously like a buddy movie, two people really. So, you know, signing onto it was also a bit like All Manners. It was like right back with non-actors, you know, obviously he's neurodiverse as well. But to be honest, I don't think that really changes it that much. A non-actor is a non-actor, whether you're neurodiverse or not. And it was just amazing, man. And he was just like, he was wicked, man. Everything that you see on screen, like his energy is amazing, man. His mum, dad, and his dog, Cashel, he was always floating about and that. And they were just like, it was just the most beautiful thing, man. And Eddie created an amazing vibe on set. Just like you said, I knew from the beginning when I signed on to that, I'm like, right, this is, and I'm going to show Leo how you lead a set as well, with manners and grace and kindness and open heart, but also seriousness and professionalism. And it was such a beautiful project, man. To be honest, if I had to say, like, what is my favorite film I'd ever worked on, that's probably my most enjoyable filming experience. Ill Manners is just always the one I say, just because heartstrings. But I Used to Be Famous was just amazing. And I was really, and every movie's a gamble, isn't it? And so when I read the screenplay, as you can imagine, I was like, how the fuck are we going to pull this off?
Yeah.
And even the last act, I was like, is this going to work? That last scene in the square, I was like, this is a bit, like, say, fantastical, like, how do we do this? And I was so happy with the tone of how we did it. And
It could easily have been cheesy or saccharine or whatever else, but it didn't. I didn't feel that at all. It felt like this, just beautiful, real story. And and that comes across as well. The joy it was to be on set. If there is ever a set where you're going to be up for going out for cast and crew meal, it feels like it's that one. You know, compared to other sets.
It's like the only time.
Compared to other sets where you're like, nah, I'm gonna work on stuff in my room. It feels 100%. Like that's the set that you'll be like, I'll be down in five. I'm on my way. Let's
go. The thing is, we were in London, weren't we? Yeah. So like,
of course.
That was the interesting thing. That was the great thing, is I could go home. We're shooting in Peckham. So I'm on the high road and I'm wearing normal clothes. I've got like muddy white Adidas high tops and, you know, I'm carrying around my ironing board with the keyboard on it and all that. A lot of the time shooting with the long lens, people aren't batting an eyelid. I'm just, you know, doing all this stuff on the high road. And then even when we were shooting on the high road, it's what I love about shooting in London, is people are just sort of like, oh, get out of the way. And they carry on moving. Like, there's not a big hoo-ha about it. But we would wrap at lunch and I'd be like, do you know what? I'm just going to go and get some hard food from up there. I'll meet you back there. How long we got? All right, sweet. And so it was such a luxury to just walk the other way from the runners in the first and seconds and thirds and go, oh, I'm just got there, go and have a chat with the woman in the West Indian, get my hard food and stewed chicken or whatever, and have that 4-minute walk back to base by myself, come back, security guards from London and all that as well, and just come sit down, whoever's there, right, just eat the food communally and then go back on set and live this London life and breathe this London life. Is something which I really want to tell more London stories and be a part of more London stories, but they just got to be right in it. And it's even more complicated because being a proper Londoner and understanding it, it means that if you show me 10 inverted commas London scripts, I'll probably have a problem with 7 of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, the you know, there's not going to be that. I won't be taking that much stuff in London, but I love it so much.
When it's right, it's right. Yeah, tell me you had screenings of it at the Peckhamplex.
Mate, they did.
Yeah.
I was in LA.
LA already, yeah.
Deep underwater.
Yeah.
I couldn't do any press.
That's rubbish. Oh, yeah.
I couldn't even go to the cast and crew.
Yeah. That's,
I couldn't go to any screenings. And I understand that. Yeah. Like, I really understand that. And when I would have liked to have, but I'll tell the truth, that's not my part of it.
Yeah.
Like, it is a relay race, and I run the race before that.
Yeah.
You know, I run the second leg, essentially.
Yeah.
Pre-production's the first one. They pass it to me, and I shift.
Yeah.
I shift, and I give it everything, and, you know, then I collapse and pass it to post-production, and they run on. And then the fourth one is they just pass it on to the public, and the public say, that's a load of shit, or that's the best thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And none of those stages are mine. Yeah, and it gets further and further away from me, and I'm just there on the other side of the 400 meter track, dealing with my fatigue and all of that. And, you know, just hoping that I got my changeovers right and I ran the fastest I could. And it's not mine after that. So in some ways, for most movies, I'm actually quite relieved.
Yeah.
When I'm like, oh no, I'm shooting, I can't do it. That one though is different because I wanted to sing from the rooftops. And it was pretty amazing how it was received, man. It was like all over the world, and like the numbers it did was amazing.
Yeah.
In America, it was number one and all this stuff. And
yeah.
it was really quite amazing. But
it's the beauty of streaming. Again, there's definitely pros and cons. As said, like, I remember because Rye Lane was coming out on Disney Plus, I remember I watched that on Disney Plus and then I was heartbroken. I hadn't bothered to get down and watch it either at the Peckhamplex or at one of these spots because it was so good and it felt so true London and things like that. It makes me lazy. But as I said, it gets things out there and spreads them about. But
it's crazy for me because I used to be famous.
Mm-hmm.
All of the Light We Cannot See, Netflix, both of them Netflix. Rebel Moon, four movies on Rebel Moon.
Yeah.
And then this year did a episode of Love, Death and Robots, which is fucking exciting.
Yeah.
In my own accent.
Amazing.
I might add.
Amazing.
And actually, not hammed it up, because I don't know how you ham up this accent, but like kind of pushed it. It was like, oh, really?
Yeah.
America, you're letting me, okay.
Let's do it.
I actively went in there thinking, let me see how much I can say stuff that is so localized and kind of hard to distinguish, but it's like, it's how we say it.
Yeah.
But all of them are Netflix.
Yeah.
I've done, all my projects have been Netflix for a couple of years. And it's neither a good nor a bad thing. Like you say, there's positives and negatives. It's amazing that these projects can be so accessible to people. And it's been really interesting watching the way that they wheel them out.
Mm-hmm.
And they have got a very different strategy to how they do things. Sometimes they'll just put them out, and sometimes they'll give it a big hoo-ha like it's a studio movie. So it is interesting. I wonder if I'll ever work for anyone ever again.
Yeah, yeah.
Feels like one of them old school Hollywood contracts where, like, yeah, they've got me.
You're locked in now.
Locked into one studio.
It's not, yeah, bad. See. Well, I mean, we're going to have to wrap things up relatively soon. I think we're going to have to just do a whole nother episode on directing, because writing and directing is a big part. Speaking of London, like, a Little River Run is a love letter to London. So I guess we'll touch upon that briefly. Where are you with that, with writing and directing and that part of your creative process? Because I think these things can be tough, because it is always, as you say, your creative dial has got a limit on it still.
Mm.
So if that is taken up by 7 months in LA and, you know, doing these different things, then you're not going to get the time or be in the headspace to be in the writing and directing mode. But what's your goal there and your outlook at the moment?
It's something that I know is inevitable.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. But I'm very patient with. I don't feel like I need to rush and push things. Writing-wise, writing all the skits and the kind of short film that we wrote for the Cass album,
mm-hmm.
Famous Last Words. That was a short that I was working on and developing, that just kind of became something else, became just an audio short that just fitted perfectly for the piece as an atmospheric piece. And, like, I'm interested in that notion as well, that, like, the writing and the directing, it kind of starts as a seed that just kind of needs to be planted. And, like, it's interesting that it can turn into different things, and in some ways serves the kind of conceptual side of acting as well. But without being my usual 1,000 words, for just fucking answer the question, you idiot. I'm waiting for the right story for the feature.
Yeah.
There is a novel which was the first time I was like, this is it. I found it. And so I've been speaking to people. Yeah, I won't say any more about that, but I'm trying to do the business to see where things are. Again, just like Little River Run, I'm preoccupied with London stories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm preoccupied with the pressures and the emotions underneath all the nameless, faceless individuals that walk past us every day in London and that we coexist next to, and the inner feelings and inside of them, underneath the surface of these clear kind of like stereotypes and boxes that we will just so easily put people in London, and how London can be represented. So yeah, we'll see about the thing that I would like to develop,
mm-hmm.
because that's not my choice, so the world will have to get on board with that. But we'll see. You know, I always have these ideas about like a kind of alumni of like generation of us all like wanting to tell stories about our generation and different sides of it, whether it's northeast Essex, wherever it is. It's like, whether you're 35 or 45, I feel like there's so many of us that are trying to do things by ourselves and banging our heads against a brick wall and trying to do this and trying to hustle stuff. And it's so hard to do it by yourself.
Mm.
And so many of us, like, I know I'm willing to contribute and help people and uplift people and where we can, but it's like we're so isolated, especially when we're developing films.
Yeah. Yeah,
so I constantly have this idea and speak to people about it.
You know I know about this.
Yeah.
I know about this. Fully. It's a mad one.
Yeah.
It can be such a behind closed doors journey. Mm. Like, you can get, there can be so much of that journey done in complete isolation. And that's weird.
It is weird, but it's also not always the best place for decision making.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you get despondent.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get those disappointments, kind of, it can so easily just go, because there's no one pushing it except you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's hard. So I don't know. I don't know how this alumni works or this union
works,
but I'd love to see a new generation of like London filmmakers. I'd love to see more London stories that are actually represent my, I don't just mean London, you know, actually do I? Because I'd be as interested to see something from fucking Exeter or fucking Sunderland.
Yeah.
Fully.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's actually
I can see that happening with Phil Barantini and Stephen Graham and Hannah Graham with what they're doing with Made Up Productions and with Matriarch of going, it's exactly what you're saying, except it's Liverpool. Mm. It's going, right, we want to make these stories happen and bring these things through. And it's purely a load of people coming together who care about it and want to tell it. And yeah,
and people
the more of that happening, the better.
And people in a position of power and means doing that. You know, instead of just going, should we buy a house in Spain?
I always shout my guy Gus Khan, because I think what he did on Man Like Moby and the way he involved the community and he made sure the set was on point and it in every area. And that was like, that wasn't even a man in position of power. That was a man who got his first opportunity and went, I might not get another.
Mm.
So while I'm here now, I'm going to focus on my community, my people and make this as positive a thing as possible. And
yeah, again, I think
the more of that, the better.
This has already been like a Stephen Graham appreciation post, but I'd like to add Gus Khan into that as someone I've never met. Like what a, the way he talks about his family, the way he talks about his community.
Yeah.
I truly respect and agree with his morals. And aside from that, he's really good at his job.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like, again, like what I was saying at the beginning, about actors and being unacceptable, being rude to the crew and stuff, is just like, there's two sides to this, man. You can be good at your job, but like, be a good person as well, man.
Yeah.
And serve those around you and be kind. And, you know, it doesn't mean like, he's navigated it that his career has been able to take off without it dissipating his energy and such. Yeah. Same with me.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems Stephen as well. And it's just like, you know, I feel like, people like Gus and Stephen, they're really inspirational, man.
Yeah. And Gus, like, me and Gaz have never been able to articulate in a well that's a way that's particularly helpful, but our thing has always been, you can tell quite quickly who's real, and it's just that term "real" is all he bases most of his things off. It's what we connected on, because we're like, you can tell who's real on this set.
Absolutely,
and like there's certain people that haven't ended up in contact still and things like that. But it's like, no, you know, yeah.
Well, you can tell quite quickly, but I always say to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Every time, and sometimes out loud, let's see how quickly they change.
Yeah.
Because I ain't going to change. Yeah, From the first day you see me to the last, I guarantee I'll be the same.
Yeah.
And on the next job you see me, something will be different. But
you must bear in mind, these are professional actors.
You know? They change. They switch it up. Well, and they can seem real at the beginning. And it's like, hold on, let's see.
Well, speaking of love letters to London, I'm going to wrap things up with something that we were going to do a whole podcast about at one point, about 3 years ago, just as the pandemic was ending. Because I want to talk to you, even if it's briefly, about rap legends you've been to see or you've had tickets to see and have been cancelled. Because that was a big thing in the Jazz Cafe days, in the Apollo, there'd be loads of rap legends who you'd have tickets for. I had tickets for KRS.
Did you come around the corner and see the sandwich board outside like I did?
Yeah.
Because in those days, obviously there's no social media or internet. And it was like, oh, that was
And it was so,
so
common for those, fucked. That era of rap stars because of visas and shit. So these things would be booked,
wouldn't it?
Then they'd literally try and fly.
Yeah.
They go, you can't leave, you can't come into the country because of whatever in your past.
Yeah, Slick Rick was the was definitely the height of it. It's really interesting that you asked that question now, and I've got kind of goosebumps as you said it and I thought about it. But tonight is the 20th anniversary of Asylum Speakers, the Foreign Beggars album.
Yeah.
Which was like the first album that I was part of and kind of recognized for. Mind Out was on that, my song. And Ebo Metropolis from Foreign Beggars passed away 2020. So tonight is like everyone's going to be there. Skinny Man's going to be there. Yeah, Double H, Dr. Syntax, Dabla, I've got all of the old school crew, Graziella.
None of these American acts I saw Foreign Beggars opening for, I've got a clear memory of Idea and Abilities on their first, them first coming over when they'd really blown up off Scribble Jam and stuff like this, and had their A&E Day album that was just so good. And I remember getting there and Foreign Beggars opening it all up in, I'm sure it was at like 93 Feet East or something like that.
93 Feet East, that was a proper horn. Cargo was, and all them places.
It was amazing, yeah.
Yeah, and it's mad. It's like a path back into my old life.
Yeah.
My friend Seleca, who's an amazing painter from Spain, Andalusia, we met in 2003 on a Beggars, dude, on the Beggars tour, we call it a tour, but it was a minibus of four dates up and down the country.
That's a tour, that counts.
Yeah, and he was spraying, spraying stuff up and we were spitting. And 20 years later, or 21 years later, we're, you know, the closest of friends. I go over there all the time, take my kids to go and paint in his studio. And he's selling in galleries and he's an amazing artist and we're still brothers. And so he's come over for it. And so, yeah, we're going to go tonight and go to the gig. And it's like, yeah, I feel emotional.
It must be emotional.
And scared because there's going to be loads of tributes to Ebo. And like, it's been 4 years and it's still like, still struggle to hear his verses and stuff, which is going to be a problem tonight. But
allow it all to hear. I mentioned to you, me and Chris were together yesterday because of a funeral, and it was for our mate who died 21 years ago. It was his dad passed. Shout out to Errol Knott. And I've got a weird relationship with death. Like, I'm quite comfortable with it. I talk about it a lot. I write about it a lot. I think about it a lot. And I was going to this funeral quite kind of like, fucking, can't wait. You know, I love the beauty of this the sharing of stories, the send off, the tribute. And there was numerous points it hit me where I wasn't expecting it. Anytime they said my mate Jamie's name, I was just sniffing and welling up and struggling, and I didn't expect it. But when I went home that afternoon, I consciously went on a couple of walks on my own to kind of go, right, let's not just put a TV show on, which is my normal, let's go for a walk and let's allow some of
it.
And it was really nice. I love those, I love those moments of emotion, particularly when you're not expecting them. Like, I went into that thinking, as grim as it sounds, I've seen enough death in my life. I know where I am with this. And then, as said, just, I got there and all the seats were taken. There was a row of people standing all the way around the outline of the church, and then another row in front of them, and then the doors open at the back because they couldn't get everyone in. And that alone, I knew the direct family and my two mates who I'd gone with. I didn't know any of these people, but that alone made me emotional because I'm like, how many people's lives has this man touched? That because particularly with people, you know, older, they're often the quieter funerals because there's not a lot of people left and things like that. So it was one of them where I was just, even that start, I was like, today isn't what I thought it was going to be. Like, I was ready to just be like, this is just beautiful and I love the send-off. And it was a conscious choice to go, right, allow all of it. A mate of mine, as we came out, was like, have you got a cold or something? Like, I kept hearing you sniffing. I'm like, you know, we're at a funeral, right? Like, I ain't going to apologize for that. Like, it's legit. But I'd say that tonight, man, allow that. Yeah, all that emotion is going to come and it's going to be a beautiful thing. I'm sure I've told you before, but with my mate Jamie, my favourite day of the year is the 25th of April because me and a few mates and his family always get together. I don't know if that's going to happen this year because, you know, there's been another death to be dealing with, but it's my favourite day of the year, and 21 years on, we're still doing it because it's that day that we probably tell the same stories every year, but we get to hear those stories. And you've heard those verses before, but, you know, it's beautiful. And again, it's very, obviously, it's the greatest, very raw hits, still. Man. Yeah. But I think those things are beautiful to, I love those moments now. I went from it being the day that I feared to the day that I looked forward to all year round. Because I'm like, there's going to be people, like when I was on Facebook, I was like, I know there's going to be at least one photo I've not seen before that pops up. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
I think, like, if you were going to that funeral or I was going to the gig tonight by myself, there could be reason to fear in a way.
Yeah.
But I'm with my brothers and my sisters.
Yeah.
And so I know it's going to be okay. And I'm at a place where, like, I'm more than happy to go off and have a weep or whatever, or do what I need to do. But it's also just deep in terms of, like, that being so formative for me, the Foreign Beggars, man. That was, like, a really, really important, like, it was kind of the making of us, you know. It was like really formative years and wonderful, 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 amazing,
yeah,
amazing times in our 20s, man, like early 20s. And just, yeah, just the creative journey in the underground, man. It was just, it was so beautiful what we did together. And we kind of thought it was going to last forever. We thought we were going to be young and beautiful forever. And boy, we weren't. Things have changed and some of us are gone, you know. And most of us don't, you know, practice the medium anymore. So yeah, it's a really, really interesting thing, man. And then it's like, you know, also getting to see like Skinny Man tonight, you know, I'm really excited about that because he's properly one of my heroes.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you got like Anthony Hopkins, you got Skinny Man. No shit.
Yeah.
You know, Council Estate of Mind is obviously one of the best.
Yeah.
You know, obviously one of the best albums of all time. Yeah. People listening like, what album? But for me, rather, and for my generation and for UK rap. But,
I was going to say, for UK rap alone,
it
was a different, changed so much.
And if I listen to it now, I'm like, I know every word to so many of the things. I'm like, wow, how is it still in there?
I was going
to
say, you say some, and we will wrap up at some point, I swear. You say some of us don't practice anymore or practice the art anymore. How easy is it to not practice the art anymore? Because I'm thinking more because of Cassius and like stuff that's going on that you're so, you know, involved in and around. Do you ever find yourself going, I want to, or coming up with things in your head? And
I still come up with stuff in my notes. I've still got some little bits, but it never goes more than two lines. Just like sometimes I kind of journal stuff that's like I would never want anyone to read because it's like, mate, personal.
I've talked about this on my stream recently because people always ask, oh, do you still write now you've started? I was like, I still write, and annoyingly to the fan base, I reckon I've written the best things I've written since I stopped writing. But exactly as you say, but that's because it's like two lines or three lines.
Yeah,
I've not written the best song.
No,
I've written the handful of lines that I'm like, that's better than anything I've ever written. But it's because I'm not having to turn it into a full.
No,
full you thing. Asked, it gets you, to exist.
Yeah,
and crystallized.
Like, you asked how easy it is, and like it's the only way. Like, I have no feeling towards spitting. I don't want to spit at all. If you think about it, I could finally make, you know, I could probably get DJ Premier to produce my album now. Yeah. Whereas I couldn't when I was spitting.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or I could get Pete Rock to do half and Premier to do the other half.
Yeah.
I could probably get it mixed by top people. I could probably get wicked features if you think about it.
Yeah.
I'm probably in a good position to make, to finally make that album and, you know, try and make my own matic. But, as with so many things in life, when you have the means and stuff to do it in that way, I don't want to.
Yeah.
There's nothing inside me that wants to. You know, I could have spat on loads of people's things. And people kind of have, in jest, people say like, oh, when you're coming back, you're going to give me a verse and that. And it's like, not at all. Like, I mean, in my mind, it's I don't know what to equate it to. But there's so many things in my past that I'll never go back to. It was my past. That was when I was young and, you know, it was fun and, also, the nature of the medium, man. You know, rap and hip-hop. And I was listening to Machiavelli this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Just came back into my mind. So that was what I was listening to when I was on my motorbike. And, you know, the misogyny and all of that. I as a person, have a huge problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
The Sonics is the making of me. And
as
moves
a nostalgic
my soul.
Rap fan.
Yeah, it moves my soul.
Yeah.
I listen to more misogynistic hip-hop than I listen to anything that aligns with my moral code.
Yeah.
Now, I can make peace with that listening to it and also have no choice just because, you know, I love it. I love Redman too much.
Yeah.
An old dirty bastard. But to make it myself, to put my name on it, no way. No way. I can't, I saw my friend, my trainer, my Muay Thai trainer on the way down. I was on my motorbike and I stopped. I said, hey, I'm late. I ain't got time to stop for anyone, but since it's you, quick hug, bruv.
Yeah.
Eid Mubarak. And I was saying to him like, oh, he was like, where are you off to? I was like, oh, I'm just going to see my friend to record a podcast. And I was like, already feeling like, oh, no one wants to hear what you've got to say. Go, you know, no one wants to hear you talk for 2 hours, you know, and already kind of like having those thoughts. But I said to him, but I know we have meaningful conversations, meaning me and him, just like we always do whenever we speak off and on. I said, we have meaningful conversations, so I'm just going to go and have a meaningful conversation with a friend. But it's that feeling that makes me not really want to do too much press and not put myself out there like that. Yeah. That is just like, I could never rap on, I could never be on another rap song again, I don't think.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Yeah.
I'm 40, I'm 50, 60. Who knows like how things might change, the media might change, if there's a role that demands it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Found something conceptual that I could do, where I could use the medium and do something conceptually, I'm open to anything.
Yeah.
You know? Just like I'm open to tomorrow finding out I've got to do a film where I've got to be a ballet dancer and spending 6 days a week doing ballet instead of Muay Thai. Like, if that's what it becomes, or whatever, judo,
Then
okay, well, then we start that tomorrow. But I can't see it happening, man. I can't see it happening. It's so much an important part of me. You know, it's like, spitting is like, I don't even want to say my mother's breast, but it's like, I needed that milk.
Yeah.
And that was what helped me grow. But like, I don't drink that no more.
Yeah.
I'm not, it's not for it's not for the big man like me,
Yeah.
Yeah. But I love it so much. I'm such a fan. And then again, to be able to work with, be a part of Cass's music, but from the outside, never record, well, just the skits, but never record bars and that is like really interesting. I'm like, oh, this is like, this suits me. This is like good
really?
for all of us. Yeah, I really like it. I really like it because it's still number one fan.
Yeah.
And having that objectivity, having been gone from it for so long, but also having seen another industry.
Yeah.
And having tasted success in another industry that I never tasted in music means that I can go, remember how you used to do that? But in this, you do this. And like, imagine if you'd have done, okay. Oh, now I see when I got offered that and I did that. Oh, no wonder they told me, get the fuck out and lock the door. It's like you can see it so much, oversee it so much more from the outside. So I really like being a part of people's projects.
I think the crossover and the outside perspective though is fascinating. Like that's easily been a thing I found when trying to get film projects off the ground. It's like, all right, are we meant to do it that way? But in music, I would have done it this way. So that's how I'm going to do it. Mm. And we'll see how that shakes things up. Like that's how I got my break in acting was I just hit casting directors up directly, which you're not meant to do.
Mm.
And I was like, I've done it. There was so much stuff that got me off the ground because I didn't know the way it's done in this industry. Mm. So I think there's loads now that I look at analytically and say, well, if this was an album I was promoting, here's how I'd do it. I wouldn't just do a series of press junkets. I'd tour it. I'd do this. I'd do that. I'd have skits. I'd have, all these different things. It's like, I love those crossover and varied things that you can bring that aren't just going to be, well, that's how you put an album out, or that's how you put a film out, or so on and so forth.
I also think like the thing that I love about film and the thing that I've loved about like working with Cass has been the collaboration. And I feel like when I was spitting, it didn't feel like a collaboration.
Right.
All right, you were working with producers. It may have been the limits of how I used to collaborate with people.
Yeah.
But like working with producers, even when you were working with other rappers and stuff, I never felt like, I don't know, it wasn't the same. Maybe because I was never in like a group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you're not in a group, even if you are in a group, there's a level of competition rather than collaboration.
And hierarchy.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the time, are you the Gary Barlow or are you the...
The Jason Orange.
Yeah, that's it. Jason Orange, man. So yeah, I don't think you're going to get me back on the bars anytime soon, mate. But maybe that'll, maybe in 20 years, me and you do our duet album,
innit? Big comeback album.
Big comeback.
We'll see what tonight's stirs up, my friend. We'll see.
Do you know what I mean?
You might be speaking. I might have a voice note at 1 a.m.
But there was the, with bars, innit?
We've got to get the album going.
Instead of spitting in someone's ear outside the thing, I'll be spitting. Yo, I got bars, bro. Put this at the end of it. We'll see. We'll see. But I'm excited.
They're going to kick us out in a minute, so we're going to have to wrap it up. But, mate, it's been a pleasure as ever. It's one of those beautiful things you touched upon, how when we do talk, we talk deep. And there's a value in that. Like, we don't talk every day. We don't talk all the time. We could go a year or two. But when we do talk, it's beautiful. And this feels like that. I've had so many people reach out about that first time we chatted, particularly the why the fuck not. Kind of mantra of someone has to be in this role, why not me, and that kind of thing. There's so many things from there that stuck, so yeah, I appreciate getting to sit down and go through it again.
It is truly a joy, man, and you're like the only guy that that I wanted to speak to really with this stuff. And even this Rebel Moon press tour, we went Sao Paulo, Tokyo, LA thing. And I was like, I don't want to do any extra press. Don't find me no extra stuff, please. Yeah. Like, this will be more than enough. But yeah, when Pip comes calling, I know it will be meaningful. When is the right time? And that's what you started.
Exactly.
You said, oh, it feels like the right time.
Yeah.
And like, we both been sort of trying to make stuff happen, but I'm very aware now sometimes where I'm like, yeah, Pip's the right guy. But if it's not the right time for me, then let's wait. And when it's right, it will be beautiful and we'll never forget it. And I'm grateful, man.
So me and Bashy have talked about that because Bashy's never really done a big sit down, let's get into it. And we've said a few times, when the time's right, I've said open door, right. Open invitation, but when the time's right, we'll get that in.
Yeah.
But it's a joy, mate, and I look forward to all that's ahead.
Thank you, brother. Much love, man.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Ed Skrein. Another classic in the bag, and a long one. A long classic. We're tickling the chin of 2 hours. Thank you for tuning in and for listening. What a conversation, eh? I could talk to that man for we have talked for hours on end, but for days on end. Absolute dude. Absolute dude. I look forward to us working together at some point. You know, that's not presented itself yet, but all these things come at the right time. Speaking of coming at the right time, I'll be here again next week, Wednesday. You know what it is. It's the Distraction Pieces podcast. We're always here. We pretty much always have been. An episode a week for almost 10 years at the moment is what we're talking about. At least one episode a week for 10 years. No off seasons, no breaks. We're here, you're here. It's a beautiful thing. And we'll continue to be so for as long as it makes sense. And at the moment, it makes sense. So I will see you next week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.